Last week I pointed out how during Winston Churchill's wilderness years, that's 1929 to 1939, before he actually came back into the cabinet again, they were in fact a very productive period for him. Many people look back on his wilderness years and think, well, there was nothing really produced at that time, but he was the lone voice against Hitler, and it was largely because he was in the process of writing a book. And that was a book about his ancestor, John Churchill, who was the first Duke of Marlborough, and it was the book Marlborough, His Life and Times. And the emphasis really needs to be on the word times, because looking at what was actually going on during the life of the first Duke of Marlborough, during John Churchill's life, it took Churchill himself to Blenheim over in Germany, and he was able to see that Louis XIV and what he was doing back in the 1600s was in fact very, very similar to what Hitler was doing at that time in the 1930s. And so on 10th of May 1940, he became Prime Minister. He said that I felt as if I was walking with destiny, and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and this trial. And certainly God was using Churchill. He certainly used him, and it almost appears as if he was being trained during these wilderness years. And that fits with many other things that you'll find in Scripture, because God trains so many people. You'll find that Abraham, as we looked at three people last time, Abraham, Joseph, and Moses, and each of them had a period of time, a wilderness year period of time, and God, in fact, used that wilderness period to train them and to get them ready for what, in fact, was the job that they needed to do. And not only was he training them, but he also seems to be training us. And this really is what I want to move on to today, certainly I want to look into Israel, who for 40 years was literally in the wilderness, David fleeing from Saul, and also Mr. Armstrong's time in poverty. These are all wilderness years, wilderness periods, and yet they were crucial for what in fact was going to then come later on, and also obviously the church today after the apostasy. But God does use wilderness years, it appears, to train those that he works with. Wilderness doesn't mean not useless. It means he puts them in such a position to learn certain lessons that are needed. And this is, very much what we're in today, between two major works. The first, the one that took the gospel to the world as a witness to all nations that the end may come, and then the work that's going to be done through the two witnesses. And we're caught in the middle of it at the moment, waiting for that particular time to arise. Turn over with me back into Isaiah 51, which we read last time, but let's just emphasize what in fact we're looking at. Because here in Isaiah 51, remember we looked at Abraham and the fact that Abraham was remained childless. And he remained childless through all those wilderness years. You know, he was living in tents, having lived in Ur of the Chaldees and having lived in Haran. And then he comes into chapter 51 here of Isaiah. And notice what it says. It says, "Listen to me, you that follow after righteousness." Now, we are following after righteousness. We're doing our level best to do so. You know, Mr. Armstrong had the sermon, you know, hungering and thirsting after righteousness. And we desperately need that righteousness. We need to have this righteousness of God. So he's talking to us. He says, now you listen. Listen to what he is about to say. "Listen to me, you that follow after righteousness, you that seek the eternal, look unto the rock where from which you are hewn, and the hole of the pit where it's your dig." In other words, you go back to the basics, the father of the faithful. You're having to have faith. Well, you look at the father of the faithful. He says, "Look to Abraham, your father, and to Sarah that bore you, for I called him alone and blessed him and increased him." And yet for 100 years, he didn't have a child. For 100 years, and he waited until he was 100, and he waited until Sarah was 90. Until that actually transpired. So he's saying, listen to it and just look at what in fact is going on. "For the Eternal shall comfort Zion," Zion being the church. So again, is this talking directly to us? I think much of Isaiah, quite frankly, is. much of Isaiah is talking directly to the church at the end time. And Zion is the church. Jerusalem are the people associated with the church who are on the peripheries. And Israel is physical Israel. If you put those, you get those sorted out within the period of time that he's talking about, and the period of time that which Isaiah was given was the time just before Israel went into captivity. So he's talking really, the spiritual equivalent is being addressed today. So he says, listen to me, you that follow after righteousness. He says, for the eternal, he says, look at Abraham, your father, and Sarah, and look at what actually happened there. For the eternal shall comfort Zion, he will comfort all her waste places, and he will make her wilderness like Eden, and her desert like the garden of the eternal. So these wilderness years that we're in at the moment are not going to last forever. They are going to come to an end. Joy and gladness shall be found therein, thanksgiving in the voice of melody. Eventually we will see this. Eventually this time will come. But notice, he's pointing us back to Abraham. He's pointing us back to Sarah. He's pointing us back to the examples that we've been given in the past, and some of the examples that we'll actually look at today. Listen to me, my people. Give ear to me, O my nation, for a law shall proceed from me, and I will make my judgment to rest as a light to the people. Eventually the time will come. The wilderness years will be over for us. Eventually. And they will come to an end. And then the things that are prophesied thereafter will come. And we need to look at the examples that we've been given, one of whom was Abraham and Sarah, who had to wait until he was 100 and she was 90, till all hope of a child was past. I mean, how many people do you know that 190 have had a child? Even in today's modern society, I don't think anybody, quite frankly, has, as far as I know. And yet here, in totally natural means, no IVF, no anything else, total natural means, they had a child. And it's given to us an example. Let's just have a review again about Joseph. We'll turn over to Genesis 39. Should have got my new Bible, shouldn't I? Never mind, here we go. Pray there's no sudden gusts of wind, we should be all right. But Genesis 39, just notice again what, during these wilderness years, what was going on as far as Joseph was concerned. Because it says in Genesis 39, verse 1, it says, and Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him of the hands of the Ishmaelites, which had brought him from down there. And the Eternal, notice, and the Eternal was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man who was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. So even though he was in the wilderness years, the Eternal was still with him. Even though we are going through the wilderness years of this present time, the Eternal still is with us. If we are on our knees, if we keep that contact, if we keep that contact going, we should keep learning the lessons that we need to be learning on an individual basis, holding fast that which we've been given, and going to God in repentance on a continual basis, quite frankly, then God will be with us. You see, you know, this God doesn't change. This Jesus Christ, as it was at that time, doesn't change. But the God, the Eternal, was with Joseph. Jesus Christ was with Joseph, guiding him at that time. We turn over to verse 20, notice. And Joseph's master took him and put him into prison, a place where the king's prisoner was bound. And he was there in the prison. You know, he couldn't have gone into a more, you know, short of being dead. Where could he have been thrown? But the Eternal was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. So even in that dire straits, those dire straits, that position, God was still with him. God was still guiding and going with him. Now, in Genesis 4, next chapter in Genesis 40, notice verse 8, there's a certain corollary for that as far as Joseph was concerned. And they said to him, we have dreamed a dream, and there is no interpreter of it. And Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell me, I pray you. But the interpretation is going to come from God. And he understood that. He recognized that. It wasn't him. He's the big cheese. He didn't become the big cheese. It was the fact that God was the one that had to do the interpreting and had to guide what the interpretation was. You assign the same in chapter 41, notice in verse 16. It says, "And Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, It is not in me. God shall give Pharaoh an answer of peace." The interpretation of the dream of Pharaoh did not come from Joseph. It came from God. And without God's inspiration, there's no way he would know that it was 7 years of bumper years and 7 years of famine. And then if you notice in chapter 45, again, the acknowledgement that during those wilderness years that Joseph went through, he recognizes the hand of God in all of this. He says in verse 5, it says, "Now therefore do not be grieved nor angry with yourselves that you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." It was God who did it, and he recognized that. So within the wilderness years, he must have come to the realization that something more was going on. That God was with him, and he also was doing his part. He was acknowledging God to as much as he possibly could. In verse 6, he says, "These 2 years of the famine been in the land, yet there will be 5 years which there will be neither earing nor harvest." So he was aged 39 at that time, because he was 30 when he taken out of the dungeon and actually was put onto the throne of Egypt. So he's 39 when his brothers appeared. "For these 2 years of the famine in the land, another 5 years which there'll be neither earing nor harvest, and God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you that sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh, and a lord of all his house, and a ruler throughout the land of Egypt." Again, he recognized that God was allowing this to take place, allowed what came, these wilderness years to take place, to teach him lessons, to guide him, to be with him, and to guide him through the problems and difficulties. Now it's the same with us. It's the same God. It's the same Jesus Christ. The wilderness years that we have been going through recently and are yet to go through before all the aspects of prophecy all come slot into place. God is still, Christ is still the head of his church. He doesn't change. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. He simply does not change. And if we go back to the wilderness years of these examples, then we should be able to see that. And should be able to see throughout these wilderness years that we also need to trust him to reveal in due time the things that we need to have revealed to us. There are many things that we still yet to be revealed to us, and we've just simply got to leave it in his hands. He hasn't made known to us exactly how he hasn't made known to us where we're going to flee. He hasn't made known to us how it's going to work out. We know that the days of Daniel, we know the basic prophecies, they're all in place, they're all proceeding to their conclusion, but we don't know all the details. And we've got to trust him. We've got to leave things in his hands to trust him. Now, as far as Moses was concerned, he was keeping sheep for 40 years. For 40 long years, Moses looked after sheep. He basically dropped out of society as far as Egypt was concerned. And yet, at the time that he was revealed in the burning bush, you'll find that put in your notes, we won't turn there, but Exodus 4, verse 12, it talks about God being with Moses' mouth. In other words, he provides him with whatever he needs. And the contrast between Moses and Israel, we got up to Moses last time, and we'll move on now into the children of Israel themselves. But there's a great contrast between Moses and Israel. If we turn over to Hebrews chapter 11, we'll see what Paul presumably says in Hebrews 11 regarding Moses and regarding the faith that Moses exhibited during that time. And it says, Hebrews 11 verse 24, it says, "By faith Moses, when he was come of years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. So he saw his true lineage, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. First of all, he went into his wilderness years for 40 years, and then he came back, and he aligned himself with the people of Israel. He didn't align himself with Egypt. Undoubtedly, there must have been relatives within the royal family that he knew. Was it his brother? It was Pharaoh? His stepbrother. Did he know him that well? You know, we were not told, but he could have been. Esteeming the reproach of Christ richer, greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he had respect to the recompense of the reward. And by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. This is a big difference between Moses and Aaron, and also Israel as a whole. The children of Israel, as they were going out, as we'll go on and see, they proceeded in such a way as to whatever was in front of their noses at a specific time, disregarded whatever has happened in the past, disregarded what the promises of God and the word of God said for the future, and behaved very much like an animal who's going after a bucket of food. You rattle a bucket of food and the animal comes, if you've got him trained. Because it knows if it can get its snout into the bucket, it's got a mouthful of food. And that's all it's interested in. And I've seen animals literally come after a bucket of food and within seconds of death, all they were interested in was getting their nose into that bucket. Nothing else. Within the seconds of their throat being cut and the animal dying. But that was all they were interested in. That was the carnal nature. That's the nature of the animal. And that's all it's after. But they were literally, Israel for 40 years was literally in the wilderness. But Moses saw him, you know, he endured as seeing him who is invisible. He actually saw him on the mount, on Mount Sinai. As did the elders as well, but he recognized who was actually in control, looking after the things. So if we go back to Numbers chapter 20, which is what we read last time, we can see that graphically illustrated in Numbers 20, this great difference. And you know, Moses must have learnt through the wilderness years that he had. I mean, Moses had two lots of wilderness years. He had the first wilderness years by himself, or with the household of Midian. And then he had another 40 years with Israel. He probably looked back in with nostalgia at the first 40 years. But here in Numbers chapter 20, verse 1, it says, "Then came the children of Israel, even the whole congregation, to the desert of Zin in the first month, and the people abode in Kadesh, and Miriam died there and was buried there. And there was no water for the congregation, and they gathered themselves together against Moses and against Aaron." Not just simply to notify Moses and Aaron, not to say, just request, you know, can we possibly do something, no, remembering what God had done in the past, because God had already got water out of the rock. He did that before they even got to Sinai, best part of 40 years earlier, because this was towards the end of the journeying around the wilderness. But no, they were there, gathered themselves together against Moses and against Aaron and against God as well, incidentally, by implication. And the people chode with Moses and spoke, saying, "Would to God that we had died, that when our brethren died before the Eternal." The brethren died before the Eternal were the ones that... you can go back in several cases, but probably the ones they're referring to are the spies that went out there and came back and died because of the plague. "And why have you brought up the congregation of the Eternal into the wilderness, that we and our cattle should die there? And why have you made us to come up out of Egypt to bring us up to this evil place? It's not a place of seed, of figs, of vine, of pomegranates, neither is there any water to drink." They were none too chuffed. They really were none too chuffed. And Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tabernacle. Notice their reaction. Again, seeing him who is invisible. That was the big difference. And that is a big difference. You know, we can look at the conditions that we find ourselves in today. We can bemoan the state of the church, bemoan the state of the feast sites and the piddly number of people that are in attendance with us and so on. We can bemoan all kinds of things. But are we, as seeing him who is invisible, are we doing what Moses did here? Because the examples of Israel are certainly not a good one at all. But it says, Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and there they fell on their face, and the glory of the Eternal appeared to them. And if the glory of the Eternal appeared to them, and let's face it, the cloud was over the tabernacle, and a pillar of fire by night, and they went out and collected manna every morning. And so can God not make water? Can this being that was feeding them and looking after them? I mean, how short-sighted could they be? And yet, you know, we have understanding that is beyond, it just beggars belief, the understanding of the very meaning of life, the purpose of existence, why we were put on this earth, the purpose of everything that we see out of our eyes, that the world stumbles by in total darkness. And yet we can't believe God in the wilderness years to bring the wilderness years to an end. You know, we in many cases, if we're not careful, we can be very similar to the Israelites. What we've got to be aware of is that there is a different way and a different approach. And that is to look at what happened to Moses as seeing him who is invisible and recognizing where that knowledge and information came from. It doesn't come from the mind of a man. It didn't come from Mr. Armstrong. Came through him, but it did not come from him. You don't get the meaning of life via just a human mind, the human imagination. And the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, and so on. Turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And if you've got a marker, I suggest you put it in 1 Corinthians 10, because we'll go back and forth a little bit from it. We're looking at the fourth point of the two sermons, which is Israel in the wilderness years for 40 years. But what did they understand? What did they learn? Well, what we can learn is this contrast between what happened as far as Moses is concerned and others that had a different approach, and what happened in their respect to them. So here in 1 Corinthians 10, notice the two verses that are brought to bring out. In verse 6 it says, now these things were our examples, to the intent that we shouldn't lust after evil things as they lusted. So it mentions there in verse 6 and also down in verse 11, now all these things happened unto them for examples, and they are written for our admonition. All the things that are written, when you go back in there and you look in the account, they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the age are come. So let's face it, how many people had the book of 1 Corinthians? Well, in Corinth, they had it there. How many others in the church? Nobody. Not until later on. And then even through the Middle Ages, how many people had the book of 1 Corinthians? How many people were able to read this? Well, nobody. Until you got into about the 1500s, and then printing was invented. And it wasn't until the 1600s, really, until you started to get Tyndale, and therefore you started to get the King James Version of the Bible in English, and people started to be able to read this. So who is this for, predominantly? And even that at that time, they didn't have the kind of availability of Scripture that they have today. It's for the end-time church. It's for the ones that have to go through this wilderness period, the ones within the church today, right now, are able to read these words and to read the example. They happen to them for examples, and they are written, in other words, recorded, for our admonition, on whom the ends of the age are come. That's why they're there. That's why it's been written. That's why we can go back and read them. So what's it say? Well, it says in verse 1, moreover, brethren, I wouldn't have you ignorant how all our fathers were under the cloud and passed through the sea. and were all baptized to Moses in the cloud and in the sea. In other words, in a figure of speech, that they were, in a sense, baptized. And did all eat the same spiritual food? Talking about, yes, it's talking about manna predominantly, but it's more to it than that as well. If we go back to Exodus 16, we find in Exodus 16, it says in verse 14, and it says, when the dew that lay was gone up, behold, upon the face of the wilderness there lay a small round thing, as small as the hoarfrost in the ground. And when the children of Israel saw it, they said one to another, it's manna, for they didn't know what it was. And Moses said to them, this is the bread which the Eternal has given you to eat. This is the thing that the Lord has commanded, and says, every man according to his eating, an omer for every man. It wasn't just manna that was given to them every day for food, but on the Sabbath it wasn't there. And when they gathered it and kept it over one day to the next, it would rot. But if they kept it over from Friday, it wouldn't rot. And this miracle continued for 40 years. They saw it day in, day out. I mean, it was the way things were. Yet they despised the miracle. They despised what God was doing, what Christ was doing at that time, the manna in the wilderness. So, if we turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 8. Again, it was written for our admonition, on whom the ends of the age are come, so that we can go back there and read and understand. And what are we supposed to be reading? What are we supposed to be understanding? It says in chapter 8 in Deuteronomy, in verse 1, it says, all the commandments which I command you this day shall you observe to do, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land which the Eternal swore to your fathers. And you shall remember all the way which the Eternal your God led you these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you. Remember what you've learned as they went into the land. Well, chances are, again, they were carnal-minded individuals, and the chances are they wouldn't remember. But what has it been written down for? It's been written down so that we can then read, and then we can remember. And we can remember not only what they went through, but what we went through. And just understand that, no, we have been given the meaning of life. That's the gospel. The good news of the kingdom of God. The kingdom, the family, and the rulership from that king, that family, of God. That's what the gospel is. Which is the meaning of life, which is the purpose of existence, why human beings exist, to become part of the God family. Where are you going to find that? There is nowhere else. There is nowhere else at all. And you'll remember the way that the Eternal your God led you these 40 years in the wilderness, to humble you, and to test you, and to know what is in your heart. Is he talking to them, or is he talking to us? He's talking to both, because they're written and recorded for a purpose, for our admonition, on whom the ends of the age are come, to see whether you would keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you, and he allowed you to hunger, and then he fed you with manna, which you didn't know, neither did your fathers know, that he may make you know that man does not live by bread only, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Eternal does a man live. Because the mouth of the Eternal spoke and said, let there be light, and there was light. He said, let the dry land appear, and the dry land appeared. And he said, let there be manna on 6 days, and on the seventh there not be any manna. And that's exactly what happened. So, even your raiment, your clothing didn't become old on you, neither did your foot swell for 40 years. And consider in your heart that as a man chastened his son, so the Eternal your God chastened you. And so, we live by every word that proceeds. And Christ used this phrase, that a man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God, in Matthew 4:4 and in Luke 4:4. In combating Satan, in going against what in fact Satan was trying to undermine in his mind. Should we not be looking at the same? Again, these happen for our admonition on whom the ends of the ages come. Let's go back to the section over in 1 Corinthians 10. He says, and all did drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock following, and that rock was Christ. So they were following, they followed the pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud, and it was a spiritual rock that they followed. And you also, he obviously is using a play on words, because they also drank of the spiritual drink. They also drank of the physical drink as well, because of from that rock. And there's speculation as to what that rock was. The speculation is, rather than just being a rock, any old rock that you happen to come across and you hit it with a rod, or you command it or whatever, and out comes water. They wonder whether it was in fact Jacob's pillar stone that the water came out of. Now, whether that was true or not is speculative, but it has been voiced. But certainly they all drank of that same spiritual drink and that same spiritual rock, which was Christ, that was with them through that time. But with many of them God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now, that overthrow in the wilderness, if we turn back to Numbers 14, we find the account of the spies, but again, notice the difference in attitudes and mind. In Numbers 14, notice in verse 22, it says, Because all those men which have seen my glory and my miracles which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and have tested me now these 10 times and have not listened to my voice, they didn't listen to the voice. So for 40 years they ate manna, that they may listen to the voice of God in that sense. Surely they shall not see the land which I swore to their fathers, neither shall any of them that provoke me see of it. But my servant Caleb, because he had another spirit with him, and it followed me fully, him I will bring into the land in which he went, and his seed shall possess it. And he says, tomorrow turn you and get you to the wilderness, to the way of the Red Sea. In other words, go back. You're not going to go back into the land as you would have done, but you turn around, you go back down the Red Sea, and you go back into the wilderness. And for 40 years, they were in the wilderness years. They were wandering in the wilderness. This is where Churchill got his phrase, the wilderness years, from. They understood the Bible at that time. They realized what, in fact, you could mention the children of Israel in the wilderness and you wouldn't have a blank look, which you get today. But tomorrow turn you and get you into the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea. And the Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, how long shall I bear this evil congregation which murmur against me? I've heard the murmuring of the children of Israel, and they murmur against me. Now, do we murmur? Do we bellyache and complain? You know, there's many times that people I've heard various murmurings, let's put it this way, about feast sites. Murmurings about feast sites. And many times I think, well, if I could only send people down to Africa, I think maybe we would stop the murmurings, quite frankly. Thinking back to the feast sites that we've had down in Africa, they were the most enjoyable of all the feast sites, the times that we've had. I mean, they were delightful to meet the people. Now, each year we came back lighter than we went. And I was talking to you before the service about electricity. Last Sabbath we had an electric power outage here. And at home, and I left it for about 5-10 minutes and it didn't come back on, so I phoned my neighbor and his was off as well, so I phoned the electrical company. I got an automated voice system who then sensed my telephone number, asked me if my postcode was correct, and I replied yes, and this was all automated. He says, well, we know about the fault in your area. It should be fixed by 11 o'clock. And that was about 9 o'clock in the morning. So about an hour, half an hour later, something like that, it came back on again. Subsequently, later on that, I think that afternoon, or maybe it was the next day, I got a telephone call checking that everything was all right and there was no problems with the electrical supply, tripped switch or whatever else it might be. And then later on in the week, I got a survey to make sure that the response was up to scratch. Now, anyone in Africa that listens to something like that, I mean, but that's what happens over here. That's the way it's handled. And they know that if you don't look after your customers move somewhere else. But Africa, I can think back to preparing sermons by candlelight, day after day after day, and there was no electricity. Well, there's supposed to be, but there wasn't. And there was no water. We had buckets delivered to us periodically through the day, and we used to take them to the bath and wash. You have a flannel and wash ourselves down. But I say that they were delightful feasts, getting to know the brethren there. And that's the way it should be, because the fellowship is so great. And yet we've got individuals that, at times which will bellyache and moan. And it says, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation which murmur against me? See, we don't choose the feast sites. We pray about it. We ask God to please lead us and make abundantly clear where he wants us to be. If it all falls into place, then we move. If it doesn't all fall into place, then we stay. It's like you go out of your tent in the morning, you look at the cloud, and if it's moved, you move. If it hasn't moved, you stay. We don't do it. It's not for us to do it. And if we don't learn that through these wilderness years, what are we going to do when we finally end up in a place of safety and there's no running water and no, you have to sponge yourself down and everything else? Are you going to moan? Crazy. How long shall I bear with this evil congregation which murmur against me? I have heard the murmurings of the children of Israel which they murmur against me. Say to them, as truly as I live, says the Eternal, as you have spoken in my ears, so will I do to you. Your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness. And all that were numbered of you, according to your whole number, from 20 years old and upwards, which have murmured against me. And it was the murmuring that was the problem. Now we need to learn. We need to be positively minded. They say, there is grumbling on occasion. Now if there is a problem with your accommodation or whatever, go and get it sorted out. Yes, no problem. I'm not saying you put up with shoddy service. We don't put up with shoddy service. But you do it in a pleasant way. You do it in a Christian way. You don't go just basically bellyache and murmur about it. Doubtless you shall not come into the land concerning which I swear to make you dwell therein, except Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun. But your little ones, which you said should be a prey, them will I bring in, and they shall know the land which you have despised. But as for you, your carcasses shall fall in the wilderness, and your children shall wander in the wilderness 40 years, and bear your whoredoms until the carcasses are wasted in the wilderness. And after the number of the days in which you search the land, even 40 days, each day for a year, you will bear your iniquities, even 40 years, and you will know my breach of promise. He doesn't mince his words. This is Jesus Christ. He's the one who is the head of the church. And he's still the head of the church. He hasn't gone way off somewhere. He doesn't change. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. He's using wilderness years to teach Israel at that time, and he's more than that. It's happening for our admonition, on whom the ends of the age are come, and he's using our wilderness years to teach us that we also have got to make sure that we behave in a certain way. I, the Eternal, have said I will surely do it in all this evil congregation that are gathered together against me. In the wilderness they shall be consumed, and there shall they die. And, talking about the feast, I mean, it's not just Africa. That's the ones I've experienced. I mean, going back going back to when I was a child, or teen, young teen, the accommodation we had in Butlins and before Butlins, pre-Butlins, Butlins was an improvement. And over in America, those of you that went to Big Sandy, Texas, went to Tent City. They went to Tent City and you lived in tents. Now, we can go back to that if you want. That's no problem. Let's turn back to 1 Corinthians 10. 1 Corinthians 10. And it says in verse 6, it says, "Now these things are our examples to the intent we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted, neither be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play," sexually that is. "Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed, and fell in one day 23,000. Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed as serpents." But again, we can see, even if you turn back to Numbers 25, even in the account of the women of Midian and Balaam, you find the same thing, the same basic divergence of attitudes of mind. Here in Numbers 25, notice in verse 10, it says, "And the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, has turned my wrath away from the children of Israel, but while he was zealous for my sake among them, that I consume not the children of Israel in my jealousy." In other words, what Israel had done in following, it says, "And Israel abode in Shittim, and the people began to commit whoredoms with the daughters of Moab. And they actually enticed them and called the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods in this temple prostitution, basically, which is what was taking place. And Phinehas was having none of it. He basically followed God. "Therefore say, behold, I have given him my covenant of peace, and he shall have it, and his seed after him, even the covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made an atonement for the children of Israel." So Phinehas was very much different. Here is your contrast of mind, as seeing him who is invisible. Same contrast of mind you had with Moses. Well, Phinehas was the same way. He believed God, and he saw the problems which were occurring at that time. Let's turn back a couple of pages, because it talks about how Numbers 21, because we just read over in 1 Corinthians 10, where it says, "Let us not also tempt Christ, as some of them tempted and were destroyed of serpents." Well, it's referring back again here to Numbers 21, verse 4, "And they journeyed from Mount Hor by way of Red Sea to compass the land of Edom, and the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way. And the people spoke against God." Notice, they spoke against God and against Moses. "Why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there's no bread, neither is any water, and our soul loathes this light bread." In other words, the manna made bread that was fluffy and white. Or it was the, what was it, this... it was some kind of precious gum, aromatic gum coloured. It was kind of golden brown, this seed that they used to have, which is the manna. But they had it day in and day out as a miracle. And this miracle was occurring all the time. I mean, many of the children, they were 40 years old. 40 years old, and they never had anything else but manna. They'd never seen any harvesting or anything else. All that would be something in their history. They would go out each morning and gather the manna. "And the Eternal sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and many of the children of Israel died." But again, who were they? Who were they actually tuning? This has been written. It's been happened for our admonition, on whom the ends of the age come. Who, in fact, have they been listening to? in murmuring against and bellyaching against God? Well, the serpent. And therefore God allowed them to be bitten by serpents. And then they had to look to a representation that God instructed Moses to make of a serpent. And how once they saw the representation and saw what the serpent was actually behind the serpent, and what the serpent was really like as far as God's concerned, they were healed. And you wonder whether that's the reasoning behind why God made that, had Moses make the serpent to cause the healing to take place. But it was certainly a type of Satan that was against God, and it's something that God allowed the serpents to bite them because they were against God and they were against Moses. It says back in 1 Corinthians 10, "Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of serpents." And verse 10 now, it says, "Neither murmur you, as some of them also murmured and were destroyed of the destroyer." Now all these things happened to them for examples, and they're written for our admonition, on whom the ends of the world, the ends of the age, are come. And certainly, when you look at Numbers 14, if you go back there again, where we were just a few minutes ago, and read the ending part of that, where it talks about the eternal life, in verse 35, "I said, I will surely do this unto all the evil congregation that are gathered together against me. In the wilderness they shall be consumed, and there they shall die. And the men which Moses sent to search the land, who returned and made all the congregation to murmur against him, by bringing up a slander upon the land, even those men that did bring up an evil report upon the land, they died by the plague before the Eternal." You know, again, Christ, it doesn't change. "But Joshua the son of Nun, and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, which were of the men that went to search the land, they lived still, and Moses told these sayings to all the children of Israel, and the people mourned greatly." Well, but they believed, they murmured, they bellyached. Again, written for our example, on whom the ends of the age are come. And it can, you know, I bring the feast as an example, but the feast is an example that we need to take careful note of. That we don't, if there's something wrong in the feast site, let the appropriate people know. And yet, but by all means, no problem. But if you rebel against the actual location of the feast, when Christ had actually guided it, you're on dangerous ground. Dangerous ground. 1 Samuel 16. Samuel went to Jesse, and in verse 6, "It came to pass, and when they were come, and he looked upon Eliab, and said, Surely the Eternal's anointed is before him. So Samuel himself looked and said, Oh, this must be the one. But the Eternal said to Samuel, Don't look on his countenance, on the height of his stature, because I have refused him. The Eternal does not see as a man sees, for man looks on the outward appearance, but the Eternal looks upon the heart." And certainly, this was what in fact took place. And David fleeing from Saul, and David was selected and anointed king as a teenager. And it goes on, it says, "And Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. He said, Neither is the Eternal chosen this. And Jesse had one by one, each of the sons came before. And Samuel said to Jesse, Are these all your children? He said, There is remains yet the youngest, in verse 11 now. And behold, he keeps the sheep. And Samuel said to Jesse, Send and fetch him, for we will not sit down until he comes here. And he sent and he brought him in. Now he was ruddy and withal of a beautiful countenance, and goodly to look unto. And the Eternal said, Rise and anoint him, for this is he. Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brethren. And the Spirit of the Eternal came upon David from that day forward, until Samuel rose up and went to Ramah." So we see clearly that God looks on the heart, and David was anointed king, and he was a teenager. So he was just a very young man. He was probably 17, 18, something like that. But he still had many lessons to learn. If you turn over to 1 Samuel 18, go over a couple of pages, And pick it up in verse 7. And the women answered one another as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. And Saul was very angry. And the saying displeased him. And he said, they've ascribed to David 10,000s. To me they've ascribed but thousands. And what can he have more than the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day forward. So it started to cause major problems with Saul. Saul had a different spirit, a different way of looking at things. And God had seen what kind of an individual David was. But David had other lessons to learn. And the lessons to learn, he had to learn within the wilderness years. And notice in chapter 19, Saul, Michal actually, his wife, let David down through a window in verse 12, and he fled and escaped, and they therefore put an image in, or made it look like David was asleep in the bed. And in verse 18, he says, So David fled and escaped and came to Samuel, to Ramah, and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and dwelt in Naoth. So he and Samuel basically fled out. And if you go over to in chapter 22, it says, David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave at Adullam, where his brethren and all his father's house heard it. They went down there to him. And every one that was in distress, and every one that was in debt, and every one that was discontented, gathered themselves to him. And he became a captain over them, and there were with him about 400 men. And David went there to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, Let my father and my mother, pray you, come forth and be with you, until I know what God will do for me. But these were his wilderness years, where he was literally fleeing from pillar to post, and yet at the same time keeping loyal. And one advantage that he did have, notice in chapter 23, in verse 9, And David knew that Saul secretly practiced mischief against him. And he said to Abiathar the priest, Bring here the ephod. This is 1 Samuel 23, verse 9. And then said David, and the reason for the ephod was a breastplate on the priestly garments, and they contained the Urim and the Thummim. And the breastplate would then presumably glow. It looks as if it used to glow when God's presence was there within the breastplate, within the ephod. And the Urim and the Thummim would then give the answer to whatever questions were given to it. Then said David, O eternal God of Israel, your servant has certainly heard that Saul seeks to come to Keilah to destroy the city for my sake. Will the men of Keilah deliver me up to his hand? And so will Saul come down as the servant has heard? O eternal God of Israel, I beseech you, tell your servant. And the eternal said, He will come down. He said that through the ephod, through the Urim and the Thummim, and the glowing stones on the front of the ephod. So he had the ephod, and therefore he could get in contact with God through those wilderness years, through the priest that was with him, through Abiathar, who escaped after Doeg, the Edomite, fell on the priest and slew 85 people that wore the linen ephod. And so from a teenager, he's probably into his early 20s then by that time. But if you notice over in 2 Samuel 5, David was 30 years old when he began to reign. And he reigned for 40 years. And in Hebron he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years over all of Israel and Judah. So he had a difficult time, but he was 30 when he actually came out of his wilderness years eventually. So he was years literally fleeing from pillar to post. And during that time he wrote a number of psalms. You turn it over to Psalm 27. Again, the psalms were designed to be sung, and the emotion of the time is much greater within a psalm than it is within poetry, within a song. It says, "The Eternal is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Eternal is my strength and my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When the wicked, even my enemies and my foes, came upon me and eat my flesh, they stumbled and fell. Though hosts should encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war should rise against me, in this will I be confident. One thing have I desired of the Eternal, and I'll seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Eternal all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Eternal and to inquire in his temple." He was probably writing this out in the wild somewhere. He was wanting to be back in the temple area, or in the area where the temple will be, because there was no temple at that time. The tabernacle will be. "For in the time of trouble he shall hide me in his pavilion. In the secret of his tabernacle shall he hide me. He shall set me up upon a rock. And now shall my head be lifted above my enemies around me. Therefore will I offer him in his tabernacle sacrifices of joy. I'll sing praises to the Eternal. Hear, O Eternal, when I cry with my voice. Have mercy upon me and answer me. When you say, 'Seek me, my face, my heart said unto you, your face, O Eternal, I will seek. Hide not your face far from me. Put not your servant away in anger. It has been my help, O God of my salvation. When my father and my mother forsake me, then the Eternal will take me up. Teach me your ways, O Eternal, and lead me in the plain path because of my enemies. Deliver me not over in the will of my enemies, for the false witnesses arisen against me, and such as breathe out cruelty. I had fainted until I had believed to see the goodness of the Eternal in the land of the living." And then notice verse 14, the conclusion of the entire psalm. "Wait on the Eternal. Be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart. Wait, I say, on the Eternal." Now that is, who is he directing it at? Who is the one these things happened to these individuals to teach us lessons so we can go back and we can look at the things that he had to learn? In this time of rushing around, fleeing from Saul, unable to do anything about Saul himself, who wouldn't go ahead and kill him, but he was trying to escape from him all the time. It was a case of waiting for the Eternal to do it, or waiting for God to sort the problem out. How is it all going to come to fruition here now? We don't know. But we do know this, that you don't come up with the meaning of life from any other source apart from the Eternal. You can't have this creation as it is, and made as it is. You don't have this book that contains the words of the meaning of life. And once you have them unlocked through the holy days, and so many, you put all the pieces together and you realize that no, this is the path of life. This is the path and the direction of life. And if it's a word that we've had from God via Mr. Herbert Armstrong at this particular juncture in time, then the rest of it also is true. The rest of it will also come about. And we'll eventually inherit the purpose of our conversion will take place. Turn over a couple of pages to Psalm 52. Psalm 52. A little bit shorter psalm. "Why boast you?" And notice who he's talking about. He says, "David condemning Doeg prophesies his destruction." That's in the heading of Psalm 52. "Why boast you yourself in mischief, O mighty man? The goodness of God endures continually. Your tongue devises mischief like a sharp razor working deceitfully." Now, when Doeg went ahead and killed 85 priests, and Abiathar fled, managed to get away, and took an ephod with him, that was the beginning, very beginning stage of his wilderness years. So this is looking at that time, his beginning stages of his wilderness years. "You love evil more than good, and lying rather than speak righteousness, Selah. You love all devouring words, O you deceitful tongue. God shall likewise destroy you forever. He will take you away and pluck you out of the dwelling place and root you out of the land of the living, Selah. The righteous also shall see and fear and shall laugh at him. Lo, this is the man that made not God his strength, but trusted in the abundance of his riches and strengthened himself in his wickedness." In other words, he had no fear of God, that he would go ahead and he would slay you know, the rest of the soldiers wouldn't go ahead and kill the priests, but Doeg did. But I'm like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the mercy of the God forever and ever, and I will praise you forever because you've done it. And I will wait on your name, for it is good before your saints. Again, conclusion, to wait, to allow God to work it out, to keep on doing what is righteous, to keep on doing what we need to be doing. And from that action of Doeg, which this psalm has been written about, Abiathar fled, joined David, was with him in the wilderness years, and therefore he could get answers. And he couldn't just pray to God, he could also get specific answers. Now, we have specific answers as well, but it's slightly different. We pray about the feast sites. We pray about the feast sites, we really do. And in the case of the change of feast site over here in the UK, there's no question about the answer. No question at all. The thing is just slotted into place, unbeknown to us, completely independent of us. We didn't do anything to cause these things to happen. In the case of the States, no. Every indication is that we'll be back in Kentucky again, because nothing like that has happened, nothing like that has taken place. But David was able to have Abiathar there with the ephod, and therefore through that time he was able to be in contact with God and had answers from God on a daily basis. And we need to be in contact with God and expect answers on a daily basis. Now, Mr. Armstrong went through years of poverty, and yet when reading his autobiography, there were years of great happiness because of the studying the truth of God and putting first things first. Now, I'll just read the section here from chapter 35. It says, after establishing my publisher's representative business in Chicago, I aspired someday to own or build one of the finest and largest homes in a North Shore aristocratic suburb of Winnetika, with a large spacious grounds constituting an important appearing estate. I wanted to be considered important by the important. He goes on, he says, I was so zealously set on that accomplishment that became the God I worshipped and served. God could not use me as long as I had another God that was more important in my eyes than he. Yet tearing the ambition out of me was like yanking out root and branch of the very life itself. It was smashing dead everything I felt I lived for and worked for. This is the reason why he had to go through the wilderness years. And we'll come on, hopefully we've got time, we'll come on and look at the wilderness years that we're currently going through. So God first took away my business in Chicago by bankrupting every major client. Twice later, he swept away businesses that promised multi-million dollar rewards right out from under my feet. He brought me down to poverty and to hunger. But the bigger they come, the saying is, the harder they fall. And this swelled up ego came crashing down, down, down. I've been so big, so important in my own sight, there was no room left for God. But God whittled self-righteous Job down to size. God drove strutting King Nebuchadnezzar out to eat grass with the beast. God struck down Saul with blindness, changed his direction, and changed his name to Paul. And God was certainly able to knock me off my imaginary high perch again and again and again. This is what happened. I had to come to realize that all this self-importance was pure illusion. I was brought down to earth with a reality and a thud. Instead of ego, vanity and self-importance, God fed me for 28 long years on the raw and scanty diet of humiliation and poverty. Had God merely let me suffer financial reverse, even to the point of experiencing real hunger for short periods of a few weeks, I'd have bounded back and quickly set back on my idols to serve again. Had God let me suffer that kind of humiliation and poverty even for a period of a year, or even 6 or 7 years, I probably would have resumed the same sense of ego back on my feet, financial feet. So Mr. Armstrong could recognize the wilderness years. Churchill recognized the wilderness years. Abraham recognized the wilderness years. And God tells us to go and look at them. Take the examples and understand our wilderness years. But God had in mind, as the lifelong events have since proved, using me as his instrument in preparing the way for the world tomorrow, for world peace, for universal happiness, joy and prosperity, growing a worldwide work involving tremendous expenditure in his service. And he knew that he could never entrust me to handle his money in the administration of his work as long as I set my heart on money or the things that money could buy. That was necessary. I was never converted until I was brought to the place where I realized that my known nothingness and God's all-encompassing greatness, until I felt completely whipped, defeated. When I came to consider myself as a worthless, burnt-out hunk of human junk, not even worth throwing on the junk pile of human derelicts, truly remorseful for having imagined I was a somebody, completely and totally and bitterly sorry for the direction that I'd travelled and the things that I'd done, really and truly repentant. Not just what he'd done, but the direction. I told God that I was now ready to give myself and my life over to him. It was worthless now to me. If he could use it, I told him he could have it, and I didn't think that then it was usable even in God's hands. And another location in chapter 18 says, where is the true church today? That's the question that still haunted my mind in the late spring and summer of 1927. During the 6 months' diligent research, I'd run the gamut of disillusionment, doubt, confusion, frustration, which he was mentioning on the Will Tomorrow today. And finally, the sure knowledge proved that God exists and that the Holy Bible is his revealed words. This awe-inspiring experience brought a totally new subject before me to study. That's where the true church is. And remember, I had plenty of time on my hands for Bible study. Only one laundry client remained. We were now reduced to real poverty. Although I'd been beaten down and been made to completely surrender to God, giving myself to him, yet without realizing it, much of my self-pride and vanity remained. Of course, God knew this. He was yet to bring me down much lower. I was yet to be humiliated, repeatedly and thoroughly chastened before God could use me. In those days, we were constantly behind with our house rent. When we had little money for food, we bought beans and such food as would provide the most bulk for the least money. Often we went hungry. Yet looking back over those days, notice what he says, looking back over those days, Mrs. Armstrong was remarking just the other day before this was written that we were finding happiness despite the economic plight, and we did not complain or grumble, but we did suffer. I don't think any of us have actually suffered like that. Now, some of the people listening to me, yes. But I don't think anybody in this room has suffered like that. From the time of my conversion, Mrs. Armstrong has always studied with me. We didn't realize it then, but God was calling us together. And we were always a team working together in unity. So during that time, it was a case of having the great happiness, studying the truth, and pulling together. And that was the source of the happiness. But it was a wilderness time. It was a wilderness years, and during those wilderness years, God was preparing Mr. Armstrong for the work that he had to do. It's the same as Churchill. It's the same as Abraham. Abraham had to live in tents. We haven't done that yet. We've got another wilderness time to come. That will be coming. That undoubtedly will be coming. But you know, if you look at the church today after the apostasy, if we look at putting first things first and understanding what we've just been reading about over these examples that we look back in scriptures and see, we can see that the important thing is to focus on what God is really doing and will do, to get our mind focused on God and get it off our own immediate environment. I mean, the Israelites of old had their mind on their immediate environment, and that was what was causing the problem. Moses, on the other hand, saw him that is as is invisible. And quite frankly, that was the only way to look. It's Caleb and Joshua, the same. They recognized the things that had happened in the past, and they extended those into the future. Now, if we turn over to Daniel chapter 12, just hit a few of these high spots here regarding our own position that we find ourselves in today. We need to understand that in Daniel 12, the indication that the shattering that was currently the phase that we're in, the wilderness years that we're in, the shattered church phase that we're in, is a temporary phase. It is not going to go on forever. It'll go on as long as it's needed, as long as Christ then learns what we are really made of. Now I know, he said of Abraham, that you have not withheld your only son from me. Well, now he will know what direction we're going to take ourselves in. But here in Daniel 12, verse 7, it says, I heard the man, well, verse 6, and one of the men clothed in linen, which said upon the waters of the river, how long shall it be to the end of these wonders? Whereas, when is this all going to finish? And I heard the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the rivers, when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven. And he swore to him that lives forever, that it shall be for a time, times and a half, 1,260 days. 1,260 days. And it says, well, in the RSV it says, and when the shattering of the holy people comes to an end, then all these things will be accomplished. It almost appears as if when the shattering finishes, then the days of Daniel begin. When the days of Daniel start, then Christ is as good as here. Well, we know that the 1,335 and 1,260 and so on, when those days actually start, 1,335, it's not going to be longer than that. It could be shorter, because the days, unless the days are shortened, it says in Matthew 24, it could be shorter. It's not going to be longer. So certainly when it's translated in, when the shattering of the holy people comes to an end, all these things will be accomplished. And if we turn over to Revelation 11, we see where we actually find ourselves now. We see clearly the time that Mr. Armstrong took the message, which was as sweet as honey in his mouth, and he took that message to Israel, and it's tied up with Ezekiel, Ezekiel 3 and so on. It shows that it had to be taken to Israel, and the message was taken to Israel. It was sweet as honey in his mouth, but bitter in his belly, because it was a long time in coming. But then he had to preach again, prophesy again before many people, nation, tongues and kings, and he did. As I said many times, I still remember Mr. Armstrong with King Leopold and at Bricky Wood, and he was showing him around the Bricky Wood. I remember that one specific example where he was showing him a piano in the International Lounge, but Mr. Armstrong was demonstrating it. But he went before peoples and nations and tongues and kings, and then he died. And then it says, and it was given to me a reed like a rod, and an angel said, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein. Now there is a temple to which Christ will return, is the spiritual temple of God's church. And yet God's church to which Christ will return and marry has got to be without spot or blemish or any such thing. And there are only certain... place of final training, that we've always taken as a place of safety, yes, and that hopefully will be the place of final training. But some will have require final training by going through the fire of the tribulation. It'll still be a place of final training, but a much more difficult one. And sorting out who does and who doesn't need that kind of final training is very much the purpose of what we're in today. What direction are we going? What are we doing? Are we in contact with God? Do we have oil? Do we have the Spirit of God? Are we keeping in contact? Do we get on our knees regularly? Do we study? Do we do the things that are necessary so that we, in fact, are walking with God? Measure the temple of God and the altar and those that worship therein. But the court that is outside the temple, leave it out and measure it not, because it is given to the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. And I'll give power to my two witnesses, and this is the next work that will be done, the two witnesses during those 3.5 years. But eventually, and it appears as if it'll happen before the church flees. Let's turn over to Isaiah 52. Isaiah 52. It says, "How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that brings good tidings," verse 7, "that publishes peace, that brings good tidings of good, and publishes salvation, that says to Zion, the church, your God reigns." Now, it ties up very much with the, you know, you just have to turn back a page. To chapter 51, it says, "I put my word in your mouth, and I've covered you with the shadow of my hands," in verse 16, "that I may say to Zion, you are my people." Your God reigns over his people, in other words. So, publishing peace, publishing the word in due season, that says to Zion, your God reigns. Your watchmen, now the watchmen there are not watchmen to the world, they're watchmen to the church. Because this is the context that's here. Notice what he says in verse 7. "Your watchmen shall lift up their voice, with a voice together shall they sing." So these watchmen are then going to get together and sing together. "For they shall see eye to eye when the Eternal shall bring again Zion," when the true church will indeed be recognized. And it's going to be recognized as a single entity. As it flees into the wilderness, it's going to be recognized as a single entity. Another place where this is indicated is Psalm 102. And the entire psalm, quite frankly, is worth reading. But it is talking about, "You shall arise," it says in verse 13, "you shall arise and have mercy upon Zion, for the time to favour her, yes, the set time is come." Now, remember, these words have been recorded and saved to the people of the time of the end. They're primarily written to us. "For your servants take pleasure in her stones and favour the dust thereof," that's the dust of the church, the little ones in the church. So we are in unity. "So the heathen shall fear the name of the Eternal, and all the kings of the earth your glory." That's the purpose of the church, eventually, to be married to Christ and implement the world tomorrow. "When the Eternal shall build up Zion, he shall then appear in his glory." Didn't we just sing this psalm? I think we did. "You regard the prayer of the destitute and not despise their prayer." But when the Eternal shall build up Zion, when that church does, in fact, the shattering comes to an end, when the measuring of the temple has been completed, and the watchmen sing together, see eye to eye, there is going to be a building of the church. Now, how it'll work, how it'll happen, I don't know. I do not know. Do we force the issue? No, we do not. Do you try and get disparate groups together? No, you don't. Has it happened yet? No, it hasn't. But we're very clearly instructed. Well, turn over to Revelation again, Revelation 3. Well, we don't need to read Revelation 3:11. Hold that fast that you have, that no man takes your crown. We've read it enough times. Turn to Revelation 12. But notice in verse 13, "And when the dragon saw that he was cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who brought forth the man-child. And to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she may fly to a wilderness, to a place where she is nourished for a time, times and half a time, 3.5 years, 1,260 days, from the face of the serpent. And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood, but the woman may be caused to be taken away." And that flood is the probably armies of some description. The earth helped the woman. But she's seen as a single church, seen as one church at that time. And quite frankly, what's the being taken into the wilderness years? Taken into 3.5 years in the wilderness, literally. Now, what is our attitude of mind going to be in that time? Are we going to be allowed to go if we're going to be bellyaching and moaning like Israelites? Is that going to be the attitude of mind? Is that going to be the approach, that God is going to say, right, ah, yes, you know, he says, measure the temple and the altar and those that worship therein, but the court that is outside, leave it out. Where are we going to be? You know, where are you? Where am I going to be? These are the wilderness years that we've been given, just as Moses was given some wilderness years, 40 years in the wilderness, and then he was given 40 years in the wilderness with Israel. So we'll be given this period of time in the wilderness. And then eventually, if we are measured correctly, we'll be given time in the wilderness. Now, will we bellyache and complain? If we will, at that time, the chances are we won't be there. We just won't be there. Now, let's just take one other scripture. Now, a couple of other scriptures. John 6. Let's just turn over to John 6. Because that time in the wilderness, they were given manna to eat. In verse 44, no man can come to me except the Father which has sent me draws him, and I'll raise him up the last day. So he's talking about the church, the true church. As it's written in the prophets, and they shall all be taught of God. Every man therefore that has heard, has learned of the Father, comes to me, comes to the Word. Remember, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Not that any man has seen the Father, except he that is of God, he has seen the Father. Truly, truly, I say to you, he that believes on me has everlasting life. I am that bread of life that gives everlasting life. The living Word, that's what Christ was. Your fathers ate manna in the wilderness, and they are dead. But this is the bread, this word, this spirit heritage, spiritual heritage that we've been given, coupled with this book, and reveals the understanding of this book. It's an approach towards this book. It's an approach towards everything that allows us and give us the understanding that's necessary. This is the bread that comes down from heaven, that a man may eat thereof and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If any man eat of this bread, he'll live forever. So this bread, which was literally, it says, and the bread that I will give is my flesh, which I give for the life of the world. It's the living Christ. We walk in living flesh, in living flesh that is the flesh of the brother of Christ, the sister of Christ. And it says in verse 57, it says, as a living Father has sent me, I live by the Father, and so he that eats me, even he shall live by me. This is that bread which came down from heaven, not as your fathers ate the manna and are dead. He that eats this bread shall live forever. And it's the Word of God. It causes you to know that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. And that's what we have to do. It's living by every word. It's taking the spiritual heritage, which is the way to study the scriptures, the way to approach life, the way to do anything and everything, and then it's living that way that is revealed through the scriptures. Then these things he said in the synagogue as he taught in Capernaum, and many therefore his disciples, when they had heard this saying, it's a hard saying, who can bear it? And Jesus knew in himself, and his disciples murmured, and said, does this offend you? What if you see the Son of Man ascend where he was before? It's the Spirit that makes alive. The flesh profits nothing, but the words that I speak to you, they are spirit, and they are life. And it's recognizing that, it's making sure that we are understanding that, as we wait through these wilderness years. Okay, final scripture, Luke chapter 12. You know, Winston Churchill said when he was made Prime Minister, I was conscious of a profound sense of relief. At last I had the authority to give directions over the whole scene. I felt as if I was walking with destiny, and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and this trial. I slept soundly and had no need for cheering dreams. Facts are better than dreams. Are we going to feel something similar when we finally get to a point where the wilderness years and the lessons learned through these wilderness years are about to be used. That's what it's aiming for. That's why we have the wilderness years. That's why all these individuals had these wilderness years. God used Mr. Churchill to save the nation physically. And he trained him during the wilderness years, the history of Marlborough, around the 1600s. But God is also training us. He gives us the history of the individuals that came before us: Abraham, Joseph, Moses, Israel, David, Mr. Armstrong, ourselves as well. But we've got to get our own attitude straight. We've got to make sure that our attitude is straight now. And as I said, the feast is one area, a classic area that we can look at. But here in Luke chapter 12, verse 35, it says, "Let your loins be girded about, and your lights burning. And you yourselves, like men that wait for their Lord, when he will return from the wedding, that when he comes and knocks, they may open to him immediately. Blessed are those servants whom the Lord, when he comes, shall find watching. Truly I say to you that he shall gird himself and make them sit down to meat, and will come forth and serve them. And if he comes in the second watch, or comes in the third watch, and finds them so, blessed are those servants." Making use of the wilderness years, both now and also in the future. You know, wilderness, the word wilderness doesn't mean useless. And he goes on, he says, "And this know, that if the good man of the house had known what hour the thief would have come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken through. Be you therefore ready, for the Son of Man comes at an hour when you think not." And Peter said to him, "Lord, you speak this parable to us, or even to all." And the Lord said, "Who is then that faithful and wise steward that the Lord should have made ruler of his household to give them portion of meat in due season? Blessed is that servant when his Lord, when he comes, shall find so doing." And that's what we're doing as a work, is making sure that the food is available. It's the food in due season, tying it in with the events that are taking place. "Of a truth I say to you that he'll make him ruler over all that he has. But if that servant says in his heart, 'My Lord delays his coming,' I shall begin to beat the men servants and maidens, and eat and drink with the drunkards. And the Lord of that servant will come at a day when he looks not for him, and an hour when he is not aware, and will cut him in sunder, and will appoint his portion with the unbelievers. And that servant which knew his Lord's will and prepared not himself, neither did according to his will, shall be beaten with many stripes. But he that knew not and carried to things worthy of stripes shall be beaten with few. For unto whom much is given, of him much will be required, and whom men have committed much, of him they will ask the more." So we have been given an incredible opportunity, even in the wilderness years that we find ourselves in today. But just like Mr. Churchill, we'll probably look back on them, and they'll turn out to be the most productive periods of our physical lives.